A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is the Vice Guide to Right Now, your inside look into the best of Vice. It's Wednesday, September 19th. I'm Sophie Casas. Today we're talking to Vice's Krishna Andavolu about his new series, Maybe I'm Wrong, which seeks to spur meaningful conversation around some of the most contentious issues in our society. The first issue the series takes on is perhaps one of the most polarized, guns. The gun debate is incredibly complex and too often cast in black and white, when in reality, the political interests and opinions that drive the discussion tend to land in the gray. In his new series, Vice journalist Krishna Andavolu admits that he doesn't have all the answers. So he sets out to expose what might be flawed or biased or straight up wrong about his own point of view. It's an important framework to have these days as politics and media both become more and more polarized. So today, we've got Vice Executive Editor Dori Carr-Harris talking with Krishna about his new series, Maybe I'm Wrong. You can watch Maybe I'm Wrong on Viceland.
So your new series is called Maybe I'm Wrong. What does that title mean, and what made you come up with this series in the first place?
I've been a journalist now for more than a decade. And when I was younger, I kind of used to enjoy being the smartest guy in the room, or at least having the curiosity to find stuff out, to share that information and to sort of like be a smart guy. And the thing that I've been realizing as I get older is that I actually like being the dumbest guy in the room. And I think that I have certain opinions based upon the reporting that I've done. I have had some experience like telling stories and making media, but I find it more interesting to see if you can make media that comes from a self-inquisitive standpoint, where your curiosity isn't an endpoint, but it's sort of the beginning to a conversation about big, thorny, tough topics. So that's kind of an angle or a way into these big conversations without being so authoritative that you discount that you might not have it all together. You might not be right all the time.
And so for this version of the series, the big, thorny issue, as you put it, that we've decided to dive into is guns and gun control and the Second Amendment. Why did you feel that this was the issue that you wanted to take on first?
First of all, it's incredibly complex. And I think it's the kind of issue that people tend to walk into the room with a preformed opinion about. And I think it comes down to some very like fundamental, visceral reactions, which is if you've had experience with firearms and guns in your life, you see them one way. If you haven't, you might see them another way. If you look at a gun, is it something that makes you feel safe, or is it something that makes you feel like you're in danger? And I think that kind of cleave in personal experience and lived experience tends to push people into two camps. And so there's very little middle ground within the debate. Whereas, in my opinion, there's a lot of middle ground in potential solutions to decreasing gun violence in the U.S. And I think that's something that most people tend to agree on. And so I think it's a good test case as a topic for how to debate hard things while keeping an open mind.
You know, you're talking a little bit about personal and lived experience with firearms. Do you think that's the only thing that makes this, you know, issue so divisive? Because it really seems to be one that generates almost instantaneous opinion or a very sort of, you know, gut reaction, and has been one that has been incredibly difficult to bridge that divide so far, even though we've been talking about this issue theoretically for centuries.
You know, lived experience can cut both ways. Like, you can be someone who's been around a lot of guns, but has suffered as a result of it. And so I think that that's a lived experience that might throw you into one camp. I think it also, there's like rural versus urban, or populated states versus unpopulated states, where you grow up And your early experience with firearms does a lot to shape how you might feel about them. So if you grew up hunting with your pop, like, they're guns. And bad guys with guns are what hurt people, not the guns themselves. But maybe if you didn't grow up hunting, you see that there's so many guns out there that it's clear that their presence itself is a danger in and of itself. And so there's, like, worldviews can be shaped by experience. I don't think it's unbridgeable. I just think that, you know, the fingers on the scale, I think, in some senses, like, the way that the NRA has posed this debate makes it very unfair. The NRA has been so good at coming up with catchphrases. The only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. Like, that's, you know, people say that. And that was, like, innovated by them, basically. So I think it's such a hard topic to come to clear answers about, because the basic set of agreement points are minimal. There's, like, not much that people agree upon. But there is a lot of public policy potential within that middle ground as well. So if you look at restricting magazine clips, restricting the size of magazine clips, restricting bump stocks and other kind of accessories, like, that, those are, like, small tactical things that I think a lot of people actually agree on. So whether it's the small tactical stuff or the big ideological stuff, like, there's just a lot at play. I mean, that's why I'm interested in it. Like, I don't pretend to have any answers. I mean, I suppose I do pretend to have some answers. But what I mean to say is, like, I think I might have some answers about it, but I'm willing to and more interested in hearing how people might think that I'm wrong than think that I'm right.
And so in sort of posing these questions, because the way that the series is set up is sort of with an opening statement, you know, that says, maybe I'm wrong, but, and then we launch into sort of an explanation of a particular issue. By starting from that place of, I have some thoughts, but I want them to be, you know, exposed or debated further, is there a hope to sort of be able to bridge partisan lines, or do you think that's really possible?
Well, let's take the premise of there are too many gun deaths in the United States. I think there are people who don't think that and think that gun deaths as they exist are a product not of the gun, but of a violence in society that isn't necessarily about public policy, but about broader issues of ethics, morals, or religion, or ways of life. I don't agree with that. I think that's not true. But there's so few places to put feet in common ground. And so I don't think that this series is going to solve the gun debate. But I do think that talking about it in civil, open dialogue is just an important civic act. And in a lot of ways, the thinking behind guns is that it's something that's so loud that people are intrinsically interested in because it has such life or death consequences. What I'm hoping is that when people engage with this material, whether it's watching the debate or watching the things online, that it impels people towards action. Because in one really cool way, like, the tragedy of Parkland showed that a bunch of kids getting together can change legislation, can express a worldview that moves the needle a little bit. And I think that kind of engagement from young people is, like, kind of the ultimate goal of what I'm trying to do with Maybe I'm Wrong.
When we're talking about taking the idea of potential solutions, like, it, starting from a baseline of there's clearly a problem here because people are dying as a result of these weapons being available. If we're talking about potential solutions to solving that problem, what are some of the areas that you decided to look at as a place where you thought that there could be, in terms of policy or a more solutions-oriented thinking, some common ground?
Yeah, sure. So I think that, you know, we started off with this idea of mental health, especially as it relates to mass shootings, because I think one of the first responses that you hear from politicians following a mass shooting is that we could have caught the signs of this. Clearly, there must have been something very disturbed about this shooter. And while that's potentially true, it is also, like, hindsight's kind of 20/20 on that stuff. If someone did something as horrific as commit a mass shooting, then it seems by definition there must be something wrong with them. And so we assign blame to this concept or idea of mental health. But in reality, sort of a lot of the data shows that people who are suffering from mental health are far more likely to be victims of violence than perpetrators of violence. So therein, the first step is the wrong step. If you're saying, okay, mental health, let's, like, really focus on that. What seems to be happening is we're stigmatizing people from being open about their mental health experiences for fear of being labeled in some fashion. And that, from, like, a harm reduction perspective, is not a great first step. Another one that is maybe a little against type for me is the idea of, can you ban the AR-15? Is that a good idea? And I think from my experience of sort of reporting on pot, like, I'm kind of anti-prohibition with everything. I think when people want something, they're going to get it. And so, you know, I did an opinion piece that said, I don't think that banning the AR-15 will do anything to curb gun violence, partly because there are too many of them out there already, but also partly it's just the wrong frame of mind to come to conversation with, because the AR-15 is such a popular weapon. You know, magazine clips that are big, or bump stocks, those are sort of smaller tactical kinds of prohibitions that I think would work. But if you say, like, the assault weapon ban, which wasn't in place, like, really worked, that's, you know, hard to back up with, like, studies that both sides agree on. And that's another problem, is that the data sets are not agreed on as well. One that I think is super interesting is about protection, home protection specifically. A lot of people cite protection as a main reason as to why they own a gun. But there are some studies that show, or rather an overwhelming majority of studies show, that a gun in the home is more likely to injure or harm someone who lives there rather than defend against an intruder. However, there was another study that was sort of done, a telephone survey of gun owners, and the results of that survey showed that there is potentially upwards of 2.5 million defensive uses of firearms in the U.S. every year. Now, that means the gun wasn't necessarily fired, but it may have deterred or protected a family member from a violent act. So therein, the data set is like, one side says, hey, we've looked at all of the crime data from the FBI in the country, and we come to one conclusion. The other side says, well, that all that data doesn't even include the real use of the gun, which is as a deterrent. Like, it's more useful when it's not fired. Like, if you're not agreeing on the data itself, like, how do you come to mutually beneficial conclusions?
It's certainly an issue where you can, like many other things, you can make the numbers prove what you want them to, or prove your POV. How could we really get past this assumption of two dueling narratives and just consistent work, which you sort of alluded to before with the NRA and their, you know, incredibly large coffers, to just keep pushing forward the same POV that both sides have for the last, you know, many years?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think I have an answer to that. I think the NRA was very successful in their lobbying specifically, and the money that they put towards politicians who had certain positions. They were really successful in a 2008 case, District of Columbia versus Heller, which surprisingly was the first time the Supreme Court said that, yes, individuals have an unfettered right to own guns for protection. That was the result of decades of legislative and judicial lobbying. So that side's got the money. It's an industry that is less sort of federally regulated than other consumer product industry, and Congress is kind of broken on it. So I think, like, if you look at that side of the equation, they've got three branches of federal government kind of on their side, and they have a boatload of money. So the other side is just sort of what we've seen is what works is kids' voices. People who, it's actually kind of similar in some senses to marijuana, which I've covered for so long, is that there's more of a generational divide than necessarily a partisan divide when it comes to young people and old people as guns are concerned, or gun violence is concerned.
So I think this is an interesting time to come back to, you know, Parkland and the sort of goal of creating more of a dialogue and hoping to be able to tap into that younger generation who either may not have made up their minds or who are just experiencing a different world with guns. I know as part of this series, one of the aspects of it is a virtual town hall that at the end, you know, of the rollout of all of these episodes, we'll be hosting to bring people from both sides of the issue to have a sort of more structured debate in the hopes of both showing the opposing sides and creating some effective dialogue there, but also potentially showing that common ground that you mentioned before. How are you planning to sort of approach that debate to try and really bring forth the most productive conversation possible?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little funny. Like, if we're decrying that it's an us versus them, or like it's so oppositional, why have a debate in order to sort of like unpack that? And so, you know, I'm questioning that to some degree, but I think the format of the debate is, it's called like an Oxford-style debate. So specifically, there are two topics. At the beginning of the first topic, we poll the audience about what they think, whether they disagree or agree with the statement that I say. And then the two debaters go at it. One is agree, one is disagree. And at the end of that topic, we poll the audience again. And so the goal is to see if people's minds are being changed. Like if the debate itself can actually open up people to consider arguments and ideas that they may have not considered in the past. And I think that very moment where you sort of hear someone talk and it opens up your mind to think a little differently, that's the moment I'm kind of going for. And we'll see. We'll see if people's minds are changed.
And so it's really not about being pro or anti-gun, but really trying to see if through a functional civil debate, as you're saying, that is removed from politics and the money in politics and propaganda, people are able to actually get back to the sort of core issues at play and think about what that means and see if it's actually possible to even change minds.
I think it's the core cognition. Like the thing is like, oh, I can put myself in your shoes for a second and understand your reasoning. Because I think like when you see a lot of media about this, based upon the outlet that's putting it out or the point of view that's coming, you either turn on or turn off.
Mm-hmm.
And so the goal is to kind of, even if someone's articulating a stance that you don't agree with, you can still come at the articulation of that stance with your synapses firing to understand where they're coming from. Because I think that's like, that's where common ground, whether it's policy or just the mere fact of being humans in the same room or watching the same thing, can be more powerful than reading, you know, another opinion piece or seeing another sort of cable news shouting match. So that's why the structure, I think, is important. That's why I think the topic is important. And then ultimately, I think that kind of cognition or that kind of that moment of thinking about it openly, honestly, and without rooting for, you know, yourself or your experience, that I think is like a civic process that is more like when I've gone through it, when it's happened to me, like I find it really rewarding. I find it like it's time well spent. My hope is that that helps engage the people who are watching this to think about the midterms, to think about registering to vote, to think about voting on election day. Because I think the biggest thing that turns me off of the democratic process is that it like doesn't matter. Like I can have my thoughts and I can vote, but it's hard to make a difference as one person. But if you're having an experience where it's actually fulfilling to yourself to like just think about things from a new way, then that is what voting is to me. It's like you're engaging with your lived experience, your rationality, your emotions, your mind, and your life. And like it all points and filters directly to a democratic process where we elect people to try to articulate those and actually make policy, make change, and affect our lives in a positive way.
What's interesting to me is this is very much about being able to break out of that rigidity.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I think the example of guns and the fact that our first sort of foray into this series is rooted in the issue of guns is a good one because, I mean, in some ways, we're starting at the hardest one.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is interesting because I think that it's what we started talking about initially. It's that gut reaction that actually isn't based necessarily in 100% rationality. And so the process of showing people that they can change their minds, that you can break out of that initial sort of like very physical and visceral reaction about an issue, showing them that the democratic process is still real, that it does still hold importance and weight, and that there is a new generation of people who are very excited to exercise their rights and their voice. How do you see this sort of progressing, not just the series, but also do you see this kind of impetus being able to make some real political change in the future?
I think as far as the sort of concept of maybe I'm wrong, I think we can apply it to any number of different intractable issues or even tractable issues. I was thinking about sort of like capitalism, you know, like this is a moment where we're thinking about capitalism in a different way. So can we inspect or interrogate core concepts in our lives and do so in ways that are sort of community-based and less, I think, less authoritative? Like, we don't know all the answers. I don't know all the answers. I'm not going to pretend I do. Even when you do a report from a news perspective, you're still, you can't speak with authority as a journalist. You can speak with some authority, which is to say integrity, but the people you talk to are the ones who are the authorities. And so that's something to keep in mind. Audiences have lost that understanding of what the core concept of a journalist is, which is not to be the smartest guy in the room, but to be the one who's asking sometimes the stupidest questions and sometimes the most intricate questions. And so I think if we can use, maybe I'm wrong, to think about the big things and the little things and the things that don't matter and the things that do matter, it's a way in to talking about things that maybe is a little more honest.
Make sure to check out Maybe I'm Wrong on Viceland. That's it for now. Thanks so much for listening. And tune in again on Friday for another Vice Guide to Right Now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.